Hi everyone, and welcome back to Clinical Conversations, Ambulance Victoria's clinical podcast. This month, we're going to be talking about family violence. While it's so important to talk about it, it's obviously a deeply confronting issue. Before we go on, if this podcast raises any issues for you, there's always help available. For Ambulance Victoria staff, help's available via our peer support and psychology services. For other listeners, there are many ways you can seek help, so please take care of yourselves and speak up if you're struggling. I'm James Oswald, a clinical practice development specialist and paramedic with Ambulance Victoria.
And I'm David Anderson, medical director of Ambulance Victoria.
David, I'm stoked to be talking about family violence today, not because it's a fun topic for certain, but it's a really difficult issue, in fact, and we as pre-hospital providers, I think we don't focus on it enough. Perhaps because it is so awful, but it's an area where I think we're increasingly learning that we can make a real difference. So I'm really looking forward to our chat today.
As am I, James, and you're absolutely right. This is a really important and perhaps previously under-recognized issue for paramedics. But when you think about it, you know, to my mind, it's really just common sense. You know, the role of the modern paramedic is to deliver emergency healthcare in the community. And it stands to reason that, a percentage of the patients who contact us have either contacted us because they're a victim of family violence, or it's noted during the paramedic's assessment of the patient that they're at risk of family violence. So for those reasons, it is an incredibly important area of practice for us. And as we'll touch on, you know, during the podcast, there's now some legislative requirements in Victoria, which essentially put a bit of a duty on paramedics to report anything that they see. So it's really important that we're over this as an area of our practice. And it would be, there's no point you and I just sitting around talking about this, James. So as with previous episodes, we've decided to bring someone who actually knows what they're talking about to join the conversation. And so I'd really like to introduce to our listeners Amber Smith. Amber is the Safeguard and Care Coordinator at Ambulance Victoria. So welcome along, Amber.
Thank you, James. Thank you, David. It's a pleasure to be here today, and I'm really also looking forward to this conversation.
Would you like to tell us a little bit about what your role involves? Because this is quite a new role for us at Ambulance Victoria.
Absolutely. So AB have really taken a different approach here by creating this safeguarding care program, and primarily that has oversight of our not just family violence work, but also the work that we do around child safety, and really looking at how we could respond better to meet the needs of those we identify as vulnerable or at-risk community members.
Now, we can't talk about our approach to family violence without talking about the MARAM framework. Can you tell us a little bit about MARAM and why is it important?
So MARAM is the Family Violence Multi-Agency Risk Assessment Management Framework, and really it's established now under law Part 11. Of the Family Violence Protection Act. You know, ultimately it's about a collaborative approach. It's about making sure that we, as for example, Ambulance Victoria, as an organisation, we're looking at, you know, what policies and procedures and our practices are improving to identify risk, but also how we then marry that and work with other services to make sure that we're all on the same page. So it's about, you know, using the same language, using the same risk screening processes to make sure that we have a shared understanding and the ability to, I guess, reduce that risk. It's all come out of the Royal Commission's work that really found that our services weren't talking to each other, that we weren't sharing the information that was important to reduce risk, and that we all probably held very important information. And if we had shared it, and if we continue to find ways to share that better, then we can reduce the risk for those and make sure that people are getting access to the services and supports they need.
Yeah, one of the things that really struck me as a big focus was this emphasis on collecting the right information and sharing it. And I think when we're talking about frameworks and guidelines, you know, I get really excited about policy. I really enjoyed reading MARAM, but I understand that not everyone's a policy nerd like me. And it's really easy to to glaze over a bit, I think, if we're talking about legislation.
Can you read the Royal Commission into Mental Health and summarise it for me then, James?
Oh, I've already read it. it's important to say, I think, that this isn't just about introducing a new requirement for paperwork that's based around a dry policy framework, although it's a very well-written framework. And I was thinking today a little bit about how, you know, the things that I could say that would impress upon people that it could have a real impact on people's lives. And I thought, statistics, that'll work. And I thought, there's plenty of awful statistics about family violence. You know, one woman dies a week in Australia, one man dies a month. But unfortunately, while I was preparing for the podcast, I got a phone call from my mum. Now, she works with a support group for people with serious mental illnesses. And she rang to tell me that one of the women in the group had been murdered in a family violence incident. And Mum went to see Judy a few months before she was killed, and she said then that she was scared. She knew that she was in danger. So it didn't completely come out of the blue, and it almost never does. There are signs that we can pick up on, you know, we're calling them evidence-based risk factors, but there are things that we can see as paramedics to help people in these situations. And ultimately, Judy didn't have to die. And she was just one of four women killed in Melbourne that week. Not across Australia, just this city. Four women in 1 week died because of family violence. You know, this is not theoretical, what we're talking about today. The Marram framework, our guidelines, our approach to family violence can be genuinely, genuinely life-saving. So our approach to managing family violence is broken down into four key elements. You've got to recognise it, you've got to respond to it, refer the patient appropriately, and record the right information. Amber, the first section, recognising family violence. What are we looking for, and why are those things important?
I think it's probably important to identify that, you know, traditionally here we may have just captured data around physical family violence incidents. And what we're seeing now is around, you know, 20% of those cases coming through paramedics are identifying, you know, that emotional and psychological family violence. We're seeing an increase in elder abuse reporting through our paperwork and documentation. You know, we're seeing even some economic and financial family abuse factors, and often they're multifactorial. So we're being able to capture that information and provide that information to family violence services for those people at risk. And that's really valuable information. Most of the cases that we're seeing, around 50%, involve serious risk factors. And around 70% of those coming through are female victim survivors. But we're also attending perpetrators of family violence. And this is probably also a new space that we're capturing some really good information that we can share with our other agencies that we work with too. One of the areas that I would like listeners to understand a little bit more and has come out of the Royal Commission work too is that all of us as services need to do better to recognise children on scene for us, you know, as victims of family violence in their own right. Now, what's really interesting is the children that we're identifying on scene and those clinicians that are capturing that information, because we're proactively sharing a lot more of that now with child protection services. We're getting a lot of feedback from the other, you know, agencies that, this is a new thing for AV. You know, we didn't hold that information on that child previously. We got some information from the ED, but we've added a whole nother piece to the puzzle because we're giving them the information about what we've seen at home, what the conversations were involved, there's observations of the environment, which have been missing in a lot of these cases. So the agencies that we're working with and the services are really grateful to have, you know, the paramedics' perspective added to that whole picture.
Yeah, to me that means that there's that many kids whose lives might change because
absolutely,
we documented, we followed up, and it made a difference. It's really exciting.
Absolutely. Yeah, it is. And I think that, you know, through the education we're doing now and starting to work to unpack a little bit more, we'll start to see that number increase. So we won't just maybe attending, for example, a female adult victim survivor, but we'll have some more information about, you know, children on scene and be able to share that information if we deem those children at risk of family violence as well, which is unfortunately often the case. I could probably say that at the moment we're finding around 45% of the cases of family violence, we actually have children on scene. So we really need to do better to make sure we're capturing the information about them too.
That's so sad and unfortunately not shocking. And that says it all, doesn't it?
It really does.
It's worth saying that, this is a Victorian framework, and we will obviously talk about our system here in Victoria, Australia, but there's also some really good principles from what we've talked about. There's things that anyone around the world could learn from.
For those of you who are listening who are not from Ambulance Victoria, our clinical practice guidelines are freely available online at cpg.ambulance.vic.gov.au or via the app store of your preference. And under the Safeguard and Care section, there's a section, a CPG for family violence, which includes some screening questions. And what I was wondering is when would a paramedic ask these questions? Would they have to be suspecting family violence first, or are there some situations where you think it's always worthwhile asking these questions? And is there any is there any response that they should be particularly worried about, or should paramedics not be afraid of asking these questions in a frank manner, like we do many other screening questions?
It's a great question, David. And, you know, what some of the feedback I've had from our workforce is that, you know, how are we supposed to know and remember all of these screening questions? And, you know, and my response is that, you know, you're not supposed to remember them verbatim, and you certainly won't use them as they're written. And a lot of these, like you touched on before too, David, are common sense. But I think that it's about understanding the purpose and then, you know, maybe adapting to your own style. Obviously, when you're engaging with a patient in the right time, you will know as a clinician when you can ask these questions in the right conversation. And often, you know, as we know, that couldn't be on the way to hospital well after you've left a scene, and it might be a disclosure en route, one-on-one in the back of the ambulance. So I would think, you know, one of the most important ones that we should be asking anyone, you know, has anyone in your family done something that's made you or your children feel unsafe? And however you ask that question, you know, the purpose is really you're trying to assess, does that person have fear? Is there any fear present? And really that very first question is the opening of the door of the conversation. You may not proceed through all of the screening questions if you don't identify family risk is present, but having a good understanding of what they are and thinking about how you might potentially ask a patient or someone in your care these screening questions, I think, is really important thinking for our clinicians to do.
That's fascinating, Amber. One of the things that I found particularly useful for my own practice was this idea that it can be really insidious. It won't be, it sounds obvious once you say it, but it won't necessarily be obvious, and the concept of screening is really important. It's not always going to be physical. It's not always going to be a black eye. It can be more insidious, can involve that coercive control, economic abuse, elder abuse. So just the basic concept that it may not be obvious, think about family violence as a possibility and screening for it, can then lead you through to doing something about it. You can't do anything about it if you don't think about it.
Yeah, absolutely right. And, you know, a lot of the times we would be with patients that are not presenting with any, you know, obvious family violence signs, but, you know, an opportunity for that information to come out at another stage through that process of care could happen, and it does happen. And I think, you know, keeping it, like you say, James, in the back of your mind, every patient we go to, and, you know, we can't assume that males, of course, aren't victim survivors of family violence. We need to keep that in mind too. And that at the older community that we attend, you know, there's some really high underreported rates. We know that elder abuse exists, and to keep that in mind too. So, yeah, it's really about tailoring the questions for the right opportunity. But if it's there in your thinking and the opportunity comes up and is right, it's a lot about trust, isn't it? You know, and clinicians are great at that. You know, we see people in their most, I guess, vulnerable states sometimes, and we know family violence is presents patterns over long periods of people's lives. So someone you may be talking to could be a victim survivor of family violence for the last 5 years. I mean, we just don't know. So sometimes opening that door to the conversation through the trust you build is where that disclosure might happen.
Thanks, Sambra. And look, you know, you mentioned, you know, being in the back of the ambulance there with the patient and the trusted role that paramedics have. And I guess the natural question for me leading on from this is how do you respond? And you know, I mean, maybe James, you know, you're sitting there in the back of the ambulance on the way to hospital. You ask the first screening question, you know, has anyone in your family done something that made you or your children feel unsafe or afraid? And they say yes, and start talking about family violence and disclose family violence to you. You know, that person's now put enormous trust in you. So, you know, how should we respond to victim survivors who are in our care in a way that, you know, accepting that we're not experts in this area, is there any particular way we should respond in a manner that will be, you know, calming and reassuring to them, but also, you know, encourage them to take the matter further, if any, you know, if that's what they want to do.
We've touched on a really important part of it, which is to recognise that we're not experts in family violence, and we don't have to be. There's no doubt that if a person discloses family violence to you, that's going to be quite confronting. It'll be a challenging conversation to have. So we do have an approach outlined in the guideline as to how to respond to those sort of situations, and the first step is to believe them. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean saying any particular thing. It's just about taking what they've said at face value, basically. And our natural inclination as paramedics is, I think, to interrogate people a little bit. Oh, you've got pain. You know, tell us about that pain. What causes it? What makes it better? What makes it worse? Where is it? To establish the facts. And to an extent, that's not particularly helpful at that moment of disclosure, establishing all of the facts, sides of the story, you know, things like that. To challenge a person on the facts is not at all helpful. They've put incredible trust in you. They've disclosed this deeply personal thing. The best thing is to accept it at face value, and then to validate the experience, and that's the second part, to recognise to them that it must have been really hard to say something like, well, thank you for sharing that to me, or even just directly, I believe you. Now, other examples are things like, it must have been really difficult for you to talk about this. I'm glad you're able to share it with me. You've absolutely done the right thing. You've done the right thing to look after yourself, to look after your children. And then once you've validated their experience, it's time to introduce the concept gently that there is help available, that you would like to offer that help or facilitate them getting that help, and then seeking their consent for to get that help and to then share information in the way that we've just been talking about.
Yeah, thanks, James. That's a really valid model. And as you were speaking there, actually, I was just thinking, you know, this is actually very similar to the principles that underlie really all types of caring, high stakes communication. I do a lot of teaching in palliative care and organ donation communication. And it's really the same principles. You know, you're there in the moment with the person, showing them through your responses and through your body language that you believe and validate what they're saying, and getting their consent to move forward. It's really important and a really good skill for anyone in healthcare to develop, really. You've raised some questions in my mind, though, that Amber is far better place than you or I to answer. And I guess the two big questions I have are, what if you get as far as you've gone, you know, you're in the back of the ambulance on the way to hospital, and you do get a disclosure of family violence, but then you don't get consent to share the information? What should you do in that situation? And I guess a similar but separate issue of what if the patient doesn't need transport? What if you decide clinically that they don't require transport to hospital based on their injuries? Or what if you recommend transport to hospital and the patient refuses? So you're now in a situation where there's no next healthcare worker for you to pass the information on to. What should paramedics do in those two situations, Amber?
Good questions. And I think this is something that we will come across, because we know that we will attend victim survivors who aren't at serious or imminent risk of family violence, but still disclose that family violence is part of their life and their experience. And what do we do with that information is a great question. So really what we do is we need consent from that person to share that information. And that's so important for a whole heap of reasons. You know, one, we can't assume this is the first time they've talked about family violence. They maybe have had previous experiences with other services where there's been negative outcomes or distrust formed. So we really have to respect someone's decision and autonomy to make that re-engagement with a family violence service. So having that consent is really, really important in those cases where they're not at serious risk or in at risk of harm from family violence. So if we weren't to transport someone, we do have some options. We can, with patient consent, contact the Orange Door. Say, for example, we're at home with that patient and facilitate that three-way conversation or make that connection for the patient to seek some family violence specialist advice. And I think that's really, really important. If that wasn't possible, we also obviously have the safeguarding care program at AV. So our clinicians can contact the program too for some advice and support. And we can facilitate further conversations around what would be the next steps further, or potentially, reach out to another service to have a warm referral type situation if we felt that was necessary.
So you mentioned patients who are at serious risk or imminent risk. What does that mean? What are those sorts of patients? What traits do they have?
There's quite a large range of serious risk factors that we can draw from when we come across patients with family violence. And really the serious risk factors have been drawn from the evidence and those victim survivors that have been at serious risk of harm or death from family violence incidents. So I was
really struck when I read through Maram at the severity of these risk factors. Like they're awful, awful things. They're things like physical assault while pregnant, access to weapons and controlling behaviours, threats to kill, sexual assault of the victim. They're awful things, and as you say, ones that are associated with a genuine risk of harm or death. And in those situations, even without, unfortunately, the consent of the patient, we need to get the police involved. Which brings us to the final part of our approach to responding to family violence, which is record. Now, one of the more important aspects of MARAM, as we alluded to earlier, is information sharing between different services and different professionals. Can you tell us a bit more about what that means?
The documentation in our patient care records is really crucial, and we probably don't have the systems to support, that really accurate capture of risk factors and family violence information and detail that we need. But that's something that we're working on to make that easier for our clinicians. So really it's reading that free text, it's understanding the paramedics' observations and conversations with their patients. And from reading that information, we're able to get a lot more of a story. But what we're doing at Safeguarding Care is having to reach out to those clinicians again to have a further conversation about what else was it that you saw, what else was it that you discussed, because it's not always in that paperwork, and we know that. And then having that conversation with clinicians tends to reveal a whole lot more information that we haven't originally had in the documentation. So while I know it's it's a big ask for our clinicians to write really detailed patient care records, and the detail you put in there really does matter, because as I said, there's no tick boxes around some of the risk factors and the detail. But if you can include that in your paperwork, it's really, really valuable for how we share that information with other services too.
Amber, you've mentioned Orange Door. Can you tell us a little bit about the services that they provide? And is that a service only in Victoria or across all of Australia?
The Orange Doors have been set up as a safety hub, sort of like that central contact point where someone could go and connect with a whole range of services. And currently I think we have 9 across the state, and the goal is to have around 16 by the end of next year. So a lot of the existing family violence services within community and health services are starting to merge into that sort of key safety hub under the Orange Door banner. And that would include our child first agencies as well. So the sector's in a little bit of state of flux at the moment, that's for sure. But at the moment, what I can do from safeguarding care and what clinicians could do on scene by contacting Orange Door is ring and have a conversation around what's going on, obviously, what the concerns are, and they will act as a bit of a triage first and foremost, and then look at what would be the next steps. So while we know Orange Door at the moment is sort of only operating in business hours, we've got Safe Steps there too as a backup, which is a 24/7 service, which of course also offers that, you know, entry point triage and let's connect you to the right service model. And again, that sort of, when we talked earlier about the intersectionality, they hold information too about making sure people are getting connected to the right services that meet their needs too. So I think having the Orange Doors is set up is a great model, because what we knew from the Royal Commission was with so many different small family violence services attached to other community health and other health services, people were slipping through the gaps. So, you know, it's hoped that this model will at least be able to bring people into an area of the Orange Door that's within their region or within their suburb that they can connect to.
Yeah, for me, that really highlights one of the key messages is that how much it matters what you write in your PCR, how you collect those risk factors, how you document every aspect of the risk factors you collected, because that information can go on to make such a positive impact in that patient's life when it's shared with other agencies, like you've talked about, that it can be, you know, genuinely life-saving, like I've said. Amber, I've learned so much from today, from today's chat and from working on this guideline. And to be honest, it makes me feel a little bit sick because of all of the signs of family violence that I've probably missed over the past 10 years. You know, if you'd asked me about family violence 10 years ago when I started with Ambulance Victoria, I probably would have said, I imagine probably a lot of paramedics would have said, of course, family violence is terrible. It, you know, it's an awful, awful thing, but you know, what can I do about it? I do STEMIs, I do major trauma. And one of the really exciting things that I've seen change in that time, in my own mindset, in other people's mindsets, is that this really is a paramedic job. That family violence is a thing paramedics can make a difference to. So thank you for speaking to us today.
Oh, it's been an absolute pleasure. And, you know, I really look forward to, you know, supporting this work ongoing, because, like you said, James, it's just so important. And it's great to see that, you know, we're just at the start of this journey, but I can already see that we're making a difference, which is, it's very meaningful work, that's for sure.
Thanks, Amber. I much like James, you know, I started out my professional life for the blood and guts and the lights and sirens, and now I see that really the most important part of what we do in pre-hospital care is the delivery of high quality healthcare to anyone who needs it, and victim survivors of family violence are a really important part of the community that we treat, and it's, you know, reading through the guideline and it strikes me as just some of the core of what we do. It's, you know, we go into a house and we see things that other health professionals may not see, and are in a unique and privileged position to collect information that may not otherwise have been available in order to help this person. So thank you for being in the role, and I hope it continues to go from strength to strength. To our AV paramedics, please use the Family Violence Guideline. It is an excellent resource. Call upon the safeguarding care team if you have any questions. And I hope you enjoyed talking about what can be a very confronting topic. And I'll relate back to what James said at the start. If this listening to this podcast has raised any issues with you, if you're within EV, you could always reach out to our peer support service or to our psychology service via 1-800-MANNERS. If you're outside of Ambulance Victoria, there will be services that you can call upon. If you're in Australia, Beyond Blue or Lifeline or any other services that you may find useful. And I want to thank you all for listening. And I'm looking forward to our next podcast coming up, which will be on all things mental health and acute behavioural disturbance. So we'll see you then.